meeting to order. It's 5 minutes after three. We have with us today Representative Miller, Representative Seaton, Vice Chair Dick, and myself, Representative Keller, chairing, and Representative Kurtula has an excused absence today. Our intent today is to hear HB 1, HCR 5, and HB 78, and I'm guessing, you know, that we probably will move HB 1 and HCR 5, and we'll do our best on HB 78. There are still some questions that we're working on that everybody seems to be aware of. So I believe we closed the public testimony on HB 1. So if the sponsor or the sponsor's representative would come up and give us just a quick overview. And also we have a amendment in front of us that you have a copy of that came from Representative Seaton. You might speak to that, and then we'll have committee discussion. Go right ahead, Representative.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. For the sake of those people keeping the records, I promised I would announce who I was. Representative Carl Gatto represents Palmer. Got that? Good man. Good man. HB 1, in the briefest way to summarize it, is really a bill about liberty as much as it's about health care. Health care is simply the vehicle to describe what liberties are we may or may be losing. So with that in mind, it simply says that the government cannot force us to purchase something that we don't want to purchase. And the background is it, and I kind of enjoy this part, that for the first time in history, the government has said it is their prerogative to tax us on something, there was a better word for it, I wish I could remember it, you don't want to, in something. Well, you don't want to do something, they can tax you on something you don't want to do. There's a better word for it, but that's basically the gist of it, Mr. Chairman. And the rest of it is pretty self-explanatory with its name. And the arguments are, well, what are we going to do about all those uninsured people? And that's not what the question is here. The question here is about liberty. And either we have the right or we don't have the right, and the government has said you don't have the right. They've used the Commerce Clause to defend their position. The Commerce Clause, in the first time in history, would be used to tax a person for not doing something, not for a product that they're making or moving something across state lines. They do have some evidence that it's been used before for that reason. But I would like to join the three other states that have already passed legislation that says their citizens cannot be compelled by the government to purchase a product that they don't want to purchase. With that, Mr. Chairman, I think I'll entertain questions.
Okay, and if the committee has questions, keep in mind we have Stacy from the Department of Law and John Sherwood for questions from the department. Any questions from the Representative Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Gatto. Just clarify the language that we have here. What I'm seeing is that we are going to exempt citizens or residents or both, people that live here in Alaska, from a federal mandate. And, mm-hmm. and of course, I'm assuming that's what the Alaska Health Freedom Act represents. But then in Section B1, but the state of Alaska can still compel or mandate requirements for those same citizens.
My understanding is that's maybe true. That's not the gist of the bill. The gist of the bill is really to say the feds can't do that to the states because we have states' rights.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the reference we have, page 1, line 12, says that does not apply to health care services provided or required by the state, a political subdivision of the state, or a court of the state, and may not impair a contract right that provides health care services. I don't know if that gets at your question. By the way, I just recalled the word was inactivity. The feds would then want to tax not only the activity but also the inactivity of not doing something. I think that carries us well over the edge for where we have federal. I'm not sure how much different that is. I think we would be on our way to anarchy and who knows where if they had that privilege.
Did you want to move your amendment?
I'm sure. Are you ready, Mr. Chairman?
Unless there's more questions, I don't see any.
I'd just like to make a quick statement.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And just in agreement with what you're doing here, if we were to allow the federal government to do this, this would be a precedent, and what other inactivity would end up getting taxed? I mean, this if we are very loud and very firm, very clear on this, we're going to get steamrolled down the road in all concerns. So you have my heartfelt support.
Thank you. Well, some of the cleanest arguments I've heard was General Motors is in trouble, so you're required to buy a Chevy. We have some bank failures, you're required to enroll in a bank. That bank in particular, the one that's having failures. Stock market's going down, time to buy some stocks. Why would those be different from requiring you to buy health care that you didn't want to do? That's my fear. And it's a big fear for me. So we'll do our part here, and this will send a message that will be collected with other messages that will ultimately, hopefully, go to the courts. And because this is really the Supreme Court decision more than anything else, and it's a court that will probably be strongly divided. It'll be a 5-4 decision. But if they make the right decision, and I hope they make it like 9-0, that the Commerce Clause does not extend to inactivity.
Follow up. And I also like to say we had testimony that was concerned about the deferred cost, that people that don't have insurance, that the people that have insurance now would have to somehow ante up for that. But my concern with the Obamacare is the deferred cost, is the fact that the next generation and generation after are going to take the deferred cost of what's happening now. I don't think this really has to do with health care at all. I think this has to do with just gathering information on U.S. citizens. So.
And remember our neighbor, the Canadians, where we had a minister in Canada said, I needed this work, and it was 6 months here, and it was 6 days in the States. He's a minister. And he went to the States and paid for it. We certainly already have a health care system that people, sheiks from the Mideast, come over. People use our health care system because it provides the best service. It isn't the cheapest by far. But there are times when you don't go for cheap. You just go for what you can get. And, you know, I can use myself as an example where I'm using our health care services provided by the state. Several of us, well, all of us do. And if we have some issues with 50 million uninsured people, you know, currently there's nobody lying in the streets dying of some illness that we don't deal with. We're just paying too much to have them treated. Heck, we're even paying for illegal aliens. So we have some things that we can fix. This is not the fix. This bill will collect taxes for 10 years and supply services for 6, which makes it look like the health care bill makes it look like it will pay its own way, but only because you collect money for a longer period of time than you pay out. The second 10 years, your children, my children, will be paying the $1 trillion that it will take to do this. I like the private sector doing it if it can.
Before the amendment, is there anybody? We've closed public testimony and everything, but I wonder if Stacy from the Department of Law or John from the Department have anything that have come up in your minds? If not, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It would be appropriate at this time to offer an amendment.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to offer amendment number one, and that would be a conceptual amendment, and that's to version A, and that's on page 2, line 9, following the word charge, remove the period and insert a semicolon, and then however, comma, liability for the cost of health services is not a penalty, period.
Object.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the intent of this amendment, and I've talked to the sponsor, is to make sure that people don't get the idea that their liability for paying their hospital bill or their doctor's bill is a penalty, and therefore they can't be required to pay that, and that they can just decline that service or that mode of receiving service. And so this is meant as a friendly amendment to clarify for everyone that paying for your services is not under the definition of a penalty under this bill.
And the reason for my objection was not just for the explanation, and maybe I'll ask Stacy to come up and speak to this, but to me the charge is understandable as a fee for services rendered, and it just seems really unnecessary. And what I'm worried about a little bit is if we clarify that here, when to me it is intuitive and according to the English language and our understanding and our principles anyway, I'm wondering if there won't be occasion then in another section of law where payment is required and this clarification is not there, that this will be actually used to make their point. In other words, I see it as maybe creating a problem, and that's why I'm a little concerned with it.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, the reason that I thought the clarification might be necessary because of the specific language on page one, that a person has a right to choose or decline any mode of obtaining health care services without penalty. And mode of obtaining health care services, I just wanted to make sure that everybody was very clear that we were not saying that you aren't liable for the costs incurred because we in statute are giving you the right to decline that mode of obtaining health care services. And so that's the total intent of this, because I think that language, I don't know how to clear up that language, but I think the language giving person a statutory right to decline a mode of obtaining health care services without penalty, just clarifying that the cost you incur is not the penalty, was somewhat necessary to clear up ambiguities, and that was it.
Representative Seaton, did you bounce that off of our drafters at all? Or?
Mr. Chairman, I gave it to the sponsor. They typed up the amendment, and I've offered it here. That's why I made it as a conceptual amendment, so that if they wanted to change the language, I didn't realize until I came in that it hadn't been drafted. I hadn't looked at it that closely. I just knew that it had been typed up. So,
I'll remove my objection. Does anyone? Seeing no other objection, Amendment 1 passes. Let the record reflect that Representative Herron joined us at about 17 after 3. Representative Seaton?
Mr. Chairman, if there's no further discussion, do you wish a motion?
Yes, I'd be okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move House Bill 1 as amended, NS27LS0006/A from committee with individual recommendations and attached to zero fiscal note.
Seeing no objection, we'll move HB 1 from committee and we'll take a short meeting while we do.
Thank you, gentlemen.
HCR 5, and we have a blank CS in front of us provided by the sponsor. So if someone wants to move that as a working document, that'd be great.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'd move CS for House Concurrent Resolution 527LS0504/B as our working document.
Say no objection. Representative Seaton, it's your bill. Would you like to speak to the changes, or would you like your staff to do that?
I can go ahead and speak to those. What we've done is we've changed the language, softened it so that it's not misinterpreted as a mandate. So what we've done is we've added the word potentially, and substituted the word promote for provide on page 5, line 26, page 6, line 5, page 6, line 10, and page 6, line 16. And in the resolve sections, referring to influenza vaccine, urges the department to look at the effectiveness of vitamin D versus vaccination through a competitive treatment effective analysis. And that's on page 6, lines 12 through 13. And then on another thing we did is there were a few corrections, and so we changed on page 2, line 1, specifying that the 2007 study showing decreased cancer rates was in a group of postmenopausal women. It had just said women, and so there was a question of whether that was being interpreted as more broadly than the study. The study was accurately reported, but so it's just adding postmenopausal women. And then on page 6, line 5, we added the word blood to clarify that the vitamin D levels are tested through blood testing. And then on page 3, line 28, International unit level of the 2010 Japanese school children study was typoed at 2,000, and it was actually a 1,200 international unit, so we've corrected that typo. And then we added a whereas that highlights the significance of the aggregate findings in the study, and that was suggested by you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate that. So that's page 26. Or page 6, lines 28 and 29. And so, Mr. Chairman, those are the changes that we've put in.
Okay. any questions from the committee? And if you have questions, also, even though public testimony is closed, we have Dr. Ward Hurlburt, our chief medical officer, online, and we can direct questions at him.
Yeah.
And I'll have one for him. But Representative Seaton?
I just made a misstatement. That's page 5, lines 28 and 29 for that whereas, not page 6. So
I saw that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the from the committee for either the sponsor or Dr. Hurlburt? Dr. Hurlburt, have you had a chance to see the CS?
This is Ward Hurlburt. Through the chair, I didn't hear you because I got a tone when the operator was unmuting my phone. Could you repeat that, please?
I was just wanting to know that if you had a copy, had a chance to look at the new CS version B of HCR5?
Yes, through the chair, all I have here is the last page that has the results on that. I did have the initial document here as Representative Seaton went through it, but I do have the part with the results on there.
Thank you, Dr. Hurlburt. That's probably all for my question. I wanted to know, I believe you expressed a caution, or at least I felt a caution, that we don't pass anything that is a clinical statement of any kind, and I was wondering if you thought we have avoided that in the language now?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would still have some concerns on that. I had suggested some other language that was more general. In going through the new results here on line 10 and 11, I believe that we certainly want to encourage people to have appropriate diet, appropriate amount of vitamins in their diet, and supplements as appropriate. But I would make a more general comment in regard to number 2 and 3 there. We do look to the recommendations of the Centers for Disease Control, the American Committee on Immunization Practices, and the American Academy of Pediatrics as far as recommendations related to immunizations. And it's not really our capacity to analyze and make the difference. These are national bodies that are well recognized, that are pretty much universally used around the country in looking to recommendations for immunization. And then in the fourth one there, recommending vitamin D for pregnant women. Again, my sense is that that's too narrow. It is more clinical. We do promote the prenatal vitamins for women, baby vitamins. I believe that I've heard that Representative Seaton in the past has been concerned and very helpful in promoting the use of folic acid during the prenatal period, because we know that reduces what are called neural tube defects, fairly serious birth defects that kids can be born with, and that good prenatal vitamins, which includes the folic acid, is important to do that. So we encourage prenatal vitamins, but not to single out just one vitamin. There are other vitamins in there that are important. So my own reaction is that this is still somewhat clinical. I appreciate Representative Seaton's efforts in being sensitive to my comments the other day. But I would be, again, more general, a little less clinical in the recommendations.
Thank you, Dr. Hulbert. would another question for – I didn't see any response here real quick, but would it be better – just an idea that I'd like to get your response to, and then the committee, of course, will make the decision here, but – would it broaden it enough if we said promote vitamin supplements, including vitamin D?
Mr. Chairman, you mean on number 4 there, promote vitamin supplements for pregnant women, including vitamin D?
Yeah, 1 and 4 I was thinking of.
I think that's reasonable. It becomes a little specific, and I may be just drawing too fine a line and being too much of a purist. It does get into what are you prescribing, what are you doing a little bit, but I don't think that's an unreasonable statement at all.
Thank you, sir, for your comments. I really appreciate your response. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And I don't have data that supports other supplements. We have clinical data. We have studies that show that preeclampsia, low birth weight, early term, more the number of C-sections, type 1 diabetes are all at greater risk if you are low in vitamin D. The studies are provided here. You know, we've had these fad kind of things like vitamin E or vitamin C or all that weren't based on any body of studies at all. They were, you know, we had vitamin C with Linus Pauling and said, hey, vitamin C is really good, and based on very little amount of study, there was a lot of public response to that. You know, I don't think that we should be saying supplements that aren't backed up by a large body of study. And I think we've provided, you know, a large body of study that shows that vitamin D is deficient in the Alaska population. We've shown that the studies that have looked at those that are lower in vitamin D are at greater risk, especially in pregnant women, for preeclampsia, you know, all these different things. And so to generalize and say that the department ought to be looking at general health of the population, which they should be doing now, gets us to a point of saying, what are we saying? This is a message from the legislature to the department that is saying we are looking at a lot of information that relates to the health of Alaskans, and we're urging the department to investigate and look at these things specifically, not looking at, oh, what's happening in Arkansas or California or in Florida, because we have a specific population that receives a lot less sunlight, which is necessary for this pre-hormone. We have studies showing that the lack of that is detrimental to Alaskans, and for us not to urge the department to specifically look at our Alaska population. There are no requirements here, but these are all based on the large body of studies that we have that are showing that these things have been beneficial to the groups we're talking about, which are our Alaskans. So at some point, if we soften this to the point of saying that the department should look after the health of the Alaskan population, and I mean, we get to the point of not urging them to look specifically at where we have seen evidence that they need to do further investigation on our specific population. And I get really concerned when we look at general population studies in the lower 48 and say, well, that's all we need to worry about. We don't need to worry about Alaskans. We don't need to worry about our latitude effects or anything else, because when you have the IMO look at it, they look at it as not for different parts of the United States based on their specific criteria, but they look at every United States citizen as if it's one person. And that, I don't believe, is being as effective in our healthcare system as we could be, and we're urging that we look at a prevention model of healthcare. So that would be my response, Mr. Chairman.
If it were a bill, I would continue my concern, but it's a resolution, and the purpose of it indeed is to raise awareness in the department and in the general populace. The concern, you know, that I have, and I'm pretty sure you share, is that we have a tendency to over-focus on particular things and sometimes miss other things that are very, very important. And so I would like to say on the record, even though I really sincerely appreciate your stunning success at getting vitamin D in front of the committee and in front of the public, I do squirm a little bit that we are picking one thing, you know, and maybe making too big of a statement when there are other possibilities. Representative Heron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not on that topic. It's that's a more on a general comment on the resolution. Is this is a question that I asked at the last hearing, is why isn't it we're referring to vitamin D3, and, you know, because of the deficiencies of not having D3 deficiencies include depression, will cause depression, back pain, bone, will affect your bone health, your immune system. So again, just for the record, I'd like to ask, why aren't we referencing D3? And I do understand the response about D2 is prescribed, but why aren't we focused on D3 specifically in the resolution?
Thank you for the question. Before I let the sponsor respond, I want to tell the committee and that Carol Baggerly, remember, she was here and made that presentation. She's also online to answer questions and may want to weigh in on that. Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The level of vitamin D in your blood is what has been determined to be the significant factor, and how you obtain that vitamin D level is can be multiple sources. It can be sunlight. It can be for those people that are vegans and want a totally vegetable-based source, they can have D2. or D3. The studies that have been done between D2 and D3 have shown that they're very close together in raising the 25 OHD blood level. And so getting so specific as to say that it should be one form or another was what we were trying to avoid, and that what we're actually looking at is the individual and the population's level of vitamin D, 25 OHD in the blood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other comments or questions from the committee? Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I will toss this to the sponsor or anyone online who would like to take a shot at it. The language that I see in the resolution section seems to lean very heavily. Well, I would say it just flat out says it. It is promoting the vitamin D supplements, and I'm curious as to whether or not we should have language in there that actually says, you know, or you should eat a couple more bananas or, you know, some other vegetation or other natural, you know, naturally occurring sources in order to obtain adequate vitamin D. And I understand vitamin D usually shows up in the presence of vitamin A, and the combination in its natural form is actually better for you than isolating one or the other or both in supplements. I wish someone could speak to that.
May I speak to that? This is Carol Baggerly.
Yes, Carol, go ahead and identify yourself and who you represent, and you can respond.
This is Carol Baggerly, Director of Grassroots Health, and our organization is a public health outreach organization specifically focused on solving vitamin D deficiency epidemic. The research on the food, I have a very explicit thing on that, because vitamin D is generally not available in foods to give you the adequate amount. For example, an average person needs or uses about 4,000 international units of vitamin D a day. In terms of fish, your beautiful Alaskan salmon, you can get maybe 400, maybe 500 international units per serving. That means 10 servings of fish each and every day. That is the most expensive amount of vitamin D you can get in almost anything. In milk, milk is fortified to 400 international units a quart. You're not going to drink 10 quarts of milk a day. So while food is nice, I mean, we all need to pay attention to food. Our bodies were meant to get vitamin D from the sun. We're not getting it from the sun. So don't forget food, but that's not where it's going to come from. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol. Further comments by the committee? What's your wishes?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move to the CS for House Concurrent Resolution number 5. Be 27-LS0504/B from committee with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note.
See no objection. The bill passes. We'll take a brief at ease. We'll do the paperwork. HB 78, we have a blank CS in front of us provided by the sponsor. And I was wondering if somebody would move that blank CS as a working document, please.
Mr. Chairman, I move CS for House Bill 78, Delta version 27-LS0147/Delta.
Okay. Seeing no objection, Representative Herron, would you tell us what is in the CS that was not in the previous version, and any other comments you'd like to make?
We just passed out a descriptive written explanation of all those changes, and I will ask staff to quickly go through them for your review, and then if it gets specific, we can try to answer your questions, sir.
Thank you, Representative Herron. And Liz, if you would identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Chair Keller. For the record, my name is Liz Clement. I'm staff to Representative Herron. The changes from the previous version, backslash I, indigo, to the current version, D, delta. The backslash I version, section 1 was completely deleted. The section would have amended the ACPE, Commission for Public Education statutes, to include their duties involved with this program. That was found unnecessary to actually list in their duty statute. The second change on backslash D, page 1, line 7, has been reworded a bit to read the loan repayments and direct incentive payments provided under this chapter. That was just to clearly include the loan repayment portion of the program in the intent language that had unintentionally been left out of the previous version. Backslash D, page 3, lines 1 through 8. This just adds criterias for the employer's matching payment in the program. This is really just a cleanup change. It adds no new criteria but consolidates two separate, virtually identical listings from the previous version of the bill into one more efficient section. On page two.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton has a question.
I'm just lost. Can you go a little slower on the page, and which page were we on there?
Thank you, Representative Seaton. My apologies. No. We had just finished page 2, line 16. If you'd like, I can back up a little bit through the chair. Oh, Representative Seaton, I do apologize. I had misspoken as well. I had said page 2, line 16. That was of the Delta version, of the Indigo version, which has been transferred to the Delta versions, page 3, lines 1 through 8. My apologies, please.
Page 3, 1 through 8.
So just a clarification question. Then page 3 of version D, lines 1 through 8, is new language, right?
Technically, the wordsmithing is new language. The effect that it has in the bill is the same as it was in the previous version.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Permission to continue?
Please continue, yes.
Thank you. On page 2, line 19, we've added a new number 9. To direct the Department of Health and Social Services to include in the program as it's developed procedures for allowable leaves of absence for the providers who participate in the program. On page 3, lines 11 through 30, we've simply elaborated and given further detail to the 12-year lifetime maximum for a medical provider program participant that was found in the previous version. We have chosen to allow an initial 3-year cycle to participate in the program as it runs on a 3-year cycle. If the provider would like to continue for an additional 3 years, and if VHSS agrees that they are still eligible to participate and the site at which they're working is still eligible to participate, they may continue for an additional 3 years. That would be a total of 6 years. If later on they return to school and further their education, for example, if someone comes to the state or comes back to the state initially to participate in the program as a nurse, if they see a need and decide later on they want to go back to med school and be a physician, they could then participate again after they've gotten their MD for one more 3-year initial period for that event, followed by one 3-year renewal. Another example would be if a dental hygienist were to become a dentist. On spanning page 3, line 31, to page 4, line 4.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Can, Can I ask a question on that? On page 3, lines 15, so a renewal period of 3 years. I thought I heard you say one renewal period. Is there a limitation of one renewal period? Or
that is the intent through the chair, Representative Seaton, that there be one initial three-year period, one renewal period if the individual still qualifies and at a site that still qualifies, for a maximum of 6 years in that first participation span, is the intent.
And just to follow up, so is there somewhere else in here that I'm missing that says that there's a maximum of 6 years, or do we need to put in a single renewal period of 3 years, or is this the only place that narrowness of the application to the 6 years is found?
Representative, Mr. Chairman, I believe we tried to cover it under line 27.
Thank you, Representative Herron. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I'm asking the questions because I haven't been through it all. So thank you. I'll look at that.
Please proceed.
So spanning page 3, line 31, to page 4, line 4, there's been new language added to ensure that DHSS will have the capability to prorate the loan repayment and direct incentive payments that they make to providers at the end of each calendar quarter to the percentage of the calendar quarter that provider has worked in their eligible position at the site. This is simply something that generally would probably put into use for the first quarter the provider works and in the last quarter the provider works. It's pretty likely that many providers will not be starting work at the beginning of a calendar quarter on the first day or ending work on the last day of a calendar quarter. Yet we'd like to provide DHSS the administrative efficiency and ease to run the program smoothly, and we feel that that will be better achieved by allowing them to pay on a calendar quarterly basis.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Representative Keller. On page 4, line 27, what used to read education loans made by the state to eligible Tier 1 and 2 tier healthcare professionals now reads education loans held by or made to eligible Tier 1 and Tier 2 healthcare professionals. This is to open eligibility for participation in the loan repayment portion of the program to people who have received loans from sources other than the state of Alaska. By keeping it in the state of Alaska, we greatly narrow our field of people who could benefit from this. And the sources we've consulted have all been between neutral and supportive to the idea of opening it up.
Mr. Chairman. All right, Representative Seaton.
And I'm trying to balance this. We have the loan repayment portion here, but it's the exact same amount of an incentive payment. Is there a reason why we're going through the complications of dealing with a loan repayment instead of the direct incentive to the individuals and let them pay off their loans?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes. In some cases, other states who run similar or semi-similar programs to this have found that participants in loan repayment programs can be exempt from paying federal income taxes on the amount that they're paid through the program. This would just provide an added benefit to those who are eligible for the loan repayment.
Thank you.
On page 4, line 25, There have just been a few words added, and loan repayment amount, if any, under AS 1829025. This would simply allow the loan repayment participants to complete the three-year program cycle and continue an additional 3 years if they remain otherwise eligible. I apologize. I may have misspoken. It would allow loan repayment participants whose loans may have been completely paid off at completion of the first three-year cycle to just as the direct incentive participants if they are still eligible for the program and still working at a site that is deemed eligible for the program to continue into the direct incentive side of the portion. This was something that was realized should be addressed thanks to Representative Seaton's questions last week. On page 5, line 23, this is just a simple language cleanup change. The previous version required that participants submit an application on a form approved by the commissioner in order to be eligible. We wanted to make sure that it was clear that not everyone who submitted an application on an approved form is eligible, but that you're only eligible to participate in the program if you submit an application and that application is approved. So that I don't just send in my form and the law tells me I can assume that I've approved to participate in this program.
Chairman. Representative Seaton.
I'm just trying to fully understand. So submit an application, and previously it said on a form approved by the commissioner, and now we're saying it that they submitted an application that and the application has been approved by the commissioner as meeting all the criteria. Is that the intent?
Through the chair, yes, that is correct, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
On page 6, line 2, this is where the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education is tied back into the bill. It just ensures that to be eligible for a direct incentive payment, to be eligible for a loan repayment, as well as meeting the other criteria listed in the bill, applicants must have an unpaid balance on one or more eligible educational loans as verified by ACPE using their expertise in paying eligible educational loans.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Seaton.
So, the for the outside loans, those that aren't made by the commission, those either federal loan or loan from another state or loan from some other organization, ACPE will gather the data on the loan and will verify that that is a eligible education loan, not anything that they have anything to do with, but just that they will review the loan and certify that that's an eligible education loan. Is that what my understanding?
Yes, Representative Seaton, that is correct. This was actually a process that was suggested partly by ACPE as something that they felt they would be able and could appropriately do within the program.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm getting my eligibilities mixed up here. On page 5, down on page 30, we're talking about to be eligible for a loan repayment. So that's for the individual. They meet eligibility and priority criteria established under A, so that means that they're eligible there. But do we have a definition of eligible loan, eligible education loan, or is that a term of art that is known?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, at this point in the bill, there is no written definition of eligible educational loan. If that's something the committee feels should be considered, I would leave that to you members and Representative Herron in particular.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On page 5, line 28, we're nearing the end, I promise.
I'm sorry, what line?
Page 6, line 2.
Oh, thank you, Representative Herron. I apologize. The former version was page 5, line 28. We're moving now to the new version, page 6, line 2. It was suggested that site prioritization, as determined by the Department of Health and Social Services, as the people there who are well-versed and familiar with the health resources around the state as well as needs, as they prioritize the need.
I don't.
Mr. Chairman.
Liz, what line was that again? Page 6 line. You said line 2, but you must have referred to, I think we must be referring to a different section, different line.
Maybe a typo.
Oh, it is a typo, with my sincere apologies, members of the committee. If I may speak to this change conceptually, and I can go back and find it in detail.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative.
I think it's on line 6 of page 6, where it says the commissioner shall prioritize, and then on line 7, eligible sites. Is that?
Yes.
Is that the correct place?
Okay. That is correct. Thank you very much for the help.
I can't resist a comment. Having been a committee aide, that's got to be one of the toughest jobs in the building. And you're doing really good. Thank you for going slow. Well, please proceed.
Well, I do appreciate the help. Thank you, the chair. So on page 6, line 6, excuse me, X that one out. On page 6, line 2, we would like to give DHSS the flexibility to prioritize sites and positions at those sites who are eligible for participation in the program based on either remoteness or the percentage of federal program healthcare beneficiaries or Medicare or Medicaid participants or a combination of the two. In large, this program is designed to help several populations. Many of them will be in remote Alaska, where it's hard to attract providers and to keep them. This program also has the flexibility, though, to help in the urban areas for certain populations, such as Medicaid and Medicare recipients, who have trouble finding providers who are willing to see them because of low reimbursement rates or any other reasons they may have.
Thank you for the explanation. Just for the record, I think we all got it, but you said the wrong thing again. It's line 6 that she just made those comments on. Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Representative Seaton.
Is the prioritization in line 6 through 8 there, is that in conflict with the definition eligible site on 18 through 20?
Let's record the question,
okay,
but
yeah.
Let her work through it.
Sure.
Okay, so the question you have asked, we want to set aside here, is if it is in conflict with lines or page 6, line 18. Where it talks about eligible site, if it is, if those two are in tension. So,
okay.
Thank you.
And one final change to note. I believe you will find it spread between page 6, line 31, and page 7, line 5. To each of these two definitions, to Tier 1 healthcare professional and Tier 2 healthcare professional, we've added the words license or exempt from licensure in the state within the professions that they practice. We wanted to make sure that this program was open only to truly qualified healthcare providers who have been trained and either licensed by the state to practice. Regarding the or exempt from licensure by the state, that is to address IHS healthcare providers who are not required to be licensed by the state of Alaska, but who are indeed licensed by someone and are rigorously trained professionals. Those are all the substantive changes. Scattered throughout the bill, there were a couple of just very grammatical changes that have absolutely no impact upon the rest of the bill. And thank you for the help in my explanation.
Thank you. You did really well. And we'll get to questions in a little bit. But first, just a little bit of orientation to what we're doing here. We have 55 minutes before we intend to gavel out at 5 o'clock. We'll deal with the questions that we can deal with. And if we're satisfied, I'm okay with moving the bill. But we want to make sure we're all satisfied. As it turns out, we have time on Thursday. We can come back if there's any questions left open-ended. And also, before I go any further, just to make sure that everybody has had their say that wants to have their say, I offered Mary a chance to testify, and I did not ask online if they won't needed the chance. You know, it was kind of a, you don't really want to testify, do you? And I just want to make sure that it's all straight. So on the record, Mary Sullivan, would you like to us to reopen testimony to testify instead of an at ease like I did? Okay, Mary declined, and you can reserve the right if something comes up that bothers you. Is there anybody online that would like to testify to me to open the public testimony? Margaret, are you online with the Alaska Pharmacists Association?
Yeah, this is Margaret.
Okay. Before you proceed, Margaret, the testimony is really close. So just one question. Did you sign up to testify, or are you there for questions?
No, I signed up to testify. I didn't realize it was closed.
And did you testify previously?
No. Our executive director testified earlier.
Okay.
I just hear more as an observer. Because I want to make sure that we move this bill along. So I'm pleased with some of the changes that have been made. And I don't really need to testify.
And Margaret, I'm not trying to keep you from testifying. So if you have something to say, I will gladly open it up for you.
I really appreciate that. I don't really have anything additional to testify to other than as a pharmacist who was fortunate enough to graduate many years ago and to come out of college with no student loans because I had wonderful parents. And now I look back and I think how great that was that when we have students that come out of school with over $100,000 worth of loans, I think this program has really encouraged them to come back to Alaska or to come into Alaska to work. And I think that it's a great program, and I hope that you can move it forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Margaret. If you have something you wanted to say later on, just send the information through the LIO, and they will let us know. We'll again close public testimony then. Okay. Okay, committee questions. Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chairman, on page 6, and maybe it's been resolved, but I was looking at the prioritization criteria and the criteria for becoming an eligible site, and it seemed that becoming an eligible site had a needs assessment and employment statistics. And so I'm trying to find out if then those are a baseline thing that, okay, if you have a needs assessment and employment statistics, now those are disregarded in the prioritization because now you are prioritizing based on remoteness and the percentage of underserved patients. And I just wanted to ask whether that's intended or whether we are intending to use the needs assessment and employment statistics as could be used as prioritization criteria, because I don't think you can prioritize based on the needs assessment or the employment statistics if up on line 6 we say that they can be prioritized based on the remoteness and the underserved, and I don't know whether that's intended or not.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I believe that was actually not intended, and I thank you for the catch. There may be room for clarification in there. I believe the idea had been that the needs assessment addressed on page 6, line 20, rolled into that would be considerations such as remoteness of site and percentage of underserved patients treated. But you are right. Those two may be at odds, and perhaps there is room for them to line up better.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman.
Any other questions from the committee?
I had one back here.
While we're on page 6, I'll go ahead and ask one. Down on line 29 there, where it talks about the qualified employment, it is stated that not less than 50% of the time is to spend on direct patient health care services. My question for the sponsor, is that appropriate? I would think that when we're investing so heavily in the doctors, that maybe 70%, just to pick another number out of the sky for discussion, might be more appropriate.
Mr. Chairman, Liz told me, we had an earlier conversation about that, and Liz followed up with it, is that in thinking that through, is maybe there is room for clarification on that, but in maybe some of the smaller clinics, maybe it may be better that the professional do some of the work so that we don't expand the bureaucracy, I guess, is a crude way of saying it. So it may be more prudent that the professional do some of that other work and maybe spend less time on direct patient health care. But maybe there is room for clarification there.
Okay. I'm satisfied with that. Representative Seaton?
And Mr. Chairman, since we're on page 6, we talked about eligible education loans, and we can address that, or we can have Diane when she comes up or something. But I just wanted to flag it, and we can wait on that. But I did want to note that I would like to get something on that. But on page 2, line 19, I'm not sure about procedures for allowable leaves of absence and quite what that means. And I guess I want some clarification. If we're paying on a quarterly basis and somebody takes a half-year leave of absence, does that mean they get paid for the half year for the two quarters when they're not there, or does that mean they are unpaid leaves of absence? I'm unsure how that works, and since we had the other part that said you're getting paid quarterly instead of pro rata, on the days of work. I'm just trying to figure that coordination between those two two articles.
Mr. Chairman, I'd, if we could, at the appropriate time, we ask the department to address that.
Okay, Representative Herring, Representative Seaton, we have that question noted. I have another question then on page 3, line 4. I just am wondering why the employer can't pay more than half of the combined incentive. What is the dynamic there? It seems to me that if an employer wants to pay more, he should be able allowed to do that, and I'm just trying to understand it.
Through the chair, or excuse me, Chair Keller, the 50%, up to 50% value that it appears in Delta version, to be honest, was just a carryover from previous versions of the bill that have been heard in previous years. In speaking with the healthcare providers and some coordinators, we've found that it may be possible, and no one seems to see a problem with opening that percentage back up to more closely really match a site's ability to pay, if they are able to pay more than the 50%. It would be up to the committee to decide whether or not they should be able to do that.
Okay, that's another
open Mr. Chairman, question. To add to that is yeah. that we talked, staff and I talked about that, and it could be as broad as 0 to 100%.
A question for the sponsor, just to make sure I'm asking you this because I'm still groping on getting the pieces all fit together, but this is very directly tied to the needs assessment that mm-hmm. the commissioner would be making based on, and then we have that open question about the eligibility of the sites, and so that it all kind of plays together at some level.
Mm-hmm.
But just if you confirm that confirms that I understand what's going on. Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Well, let's. I have an amendment, and I would like to, if you, I think it's labeled D1, Michelle, and I guess I'll propose the amendment.
Object for discussion.
Thank you. My concern is I read page 3, lines 1 through 8. Let's make sure I'm in the right spot. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I have two amendments. One's okay. A conceptual D.1, and I have one that's a ledge legal Michelle D.1.
Thank you. The one that's conceptual, the D.1, that's dealt with. We'll just ignore that. The one before us is amendment number 1, the one drafted by Jean Michelle from Legal Services. A one-page document that looks like that.
Thank you.
We'll call it Amendment 1. On top, it's D.1. There's been an objection to it. Again, a little bit of background. There's a question where if you read from line 1 there, an employer or other entity approved for participation in the program shall make non-refundable quarterly matching payments to the department. Does that make a tax? Is a question that came to my mind. You know, are we enabling a tax here? And then at what point, do you lose the ability, where is it optional and where does it become something that must be done? And then that made me think about that this is getting awfully close in my mind to a dedicated fund, which is in the Constitution forbids Therefore, I'm proposing the amendment, and frankly, I have not thought through. I just got this, and but I mean, I have not followed through to make sure it doesn't. That's why I gave you the many words background first. But if you see on page 3, line 2, after the word department, we would insert the words for deposit in the general fund. The idea being, of course, that then it's available for legislative discretion. Page 3, line 10. Representative Seaton?
Yeah. Can we, should we talk about these as we go, or should we go through?
Sure, no, that's great.
I guess my question is, if this is money that is going to the individual, does that mean that if the money goes to the general fund, that the money is as a pass-through to pay these incentives or these loan repayments is not available until after the legislature would meet and appropriate the money in a following session? Or structurally, I'm just not sure how it works.
Yeah, I would be afraid to give you a definitive answer on that. So, okay. I don't know. That's an open question. Page 3, line 10, same thing. For money appropriated for the purpose, so maybe that clarifies it a bit. So it refers to the appropriation. You all there, 3, 10, after the word department, insert the words from money appropriated for the purpose. Page 4, line 6, insert a new subsection, India. Direct incentive payments, loan repayments, and matching payments shall be made with funds appropriated by the legislature for that purpose. Page 4, lines 30 and 31, delete. And re-letter accordingly, and then page 5, following line 20, part of subparagraph C, insert, if insufficient funds are appropriated in a fiscal year, the department shall prorate payments based on the number of approved participants in the program. So I think by going through the amendment, we have answered your question, I think, Representative Seaton. So that is the amendment. Just
line 20.
The silence means we're thinking. I'm giving everybody a chance to get caught up.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Seaton.
Thanks. I guess I'm trying to figure out deleting page 4, lines 30 through 31, where it says loan repayments under this section shall be made with funds appropriated by the legislature for that purpose. We're deleting that, and we're deleting that from the loan repayment section for... Have we taken care of that someplace else, or are we, I guess I'm confused.
Yeah. We're putting it in the section back in the section, page 4, line 6, following line 6, we put it in there, and we put it in a new subsection on line 5, or page 5, line 20. Which is under the number of participants, that section, where it's, so that is where it prorates it. Okay, so if you go back then to the other place we inserted on page 4, line 6, that new subsection there is part of the description of the entire program that the healthcare, the section 1, second half there. So we've taken it out of the I think we've taken out of the loan repayment section.
Yeah, that's what I've done.
And now I would be hard-pressed to give you a paragraph or a sentence or two to, you know, that I was sure all the ramifications were understood there, but that's from Jean Michelle, and she is not online.
Mr. Chairman, so taking it out of 1829.025 and moving it to 15, it accomplishes the same thing?
I would have to get legal services up before I give you that. That's a good question.
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't believe that the drafter would do something they're not supposed to do.
How could that happen? I think what we're going to do is we've got some good questions on the table. We have Thursday open, and rather than us do the sweat here, we're going to set this aside, this bill aside for today. We're going to come back Thursday at 3 o'clock and maybe perhaps have another. I'll work with the sponsor on my amendment, and if you would, Representative Seaton, you raised several questions. One is defining the leave of absence more specifically, whether that should be done, and if so, what it should be. And then the question on the eligibility of loans. I guess I could have Diane, if you're willing, to come forward and talk to that a little bit, what loans would be eligible and what wouldn't, and whether that should be in the legislation. And the other question that came up was whether or not we should change to 1 to 100% instead of limiting it to one half. So, Diane, if you don't mind, identify yourself for the record and give us your wisdom.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, my name is Diane Behrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education. And Mr. Chair, Representative Seaton, I think it would be helpful either in the statute or in regulations under the statute to have a specific definition of eligible loans. There certainly does exist such definitions in related or similar federal loan repayment programs that we could look to. So I don't think it would be difficult to do.
Thank you so much. How about the eligibility of loans? Have a definition for what loans are eligible for repayment and which one wouldn't be?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is the definition that I think would be helpful to add here.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the leave of absence previously.
I could not speak to the leave
okay.
of absence.
Okay, I'm glad I asked. So I'm slow, but I got it. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Seaton.
So, is Diane, are you going to come back to us with some clarification? We don't know all these loan statutes and also.
What I'd like to do in that, if we could do that off the committee, if you would, if the sponsor would work with Representative Seaton and use Diane as the expert on this and come to terms and come back to the committee, I'd be delighted. Okay?
And Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
When we talked about the leave of absence, I didn't want to forget the part about this calendar quarterly repayment of the loan. I don't know if there's anybody here that can talk to us about whether a calendar quarter payment or repayment is that much more efficient than actual time that someone serves prorated or what that is, and especially if we're having loans that, I mean, I don't know if they're here and want to clear that up or not, or want to address that later, but
we have somebody in the audience nodding their head, so we'll just get you right up here. Thanks. Identify yourself for the record and give us your thoughts on that.
Chairman Keller and the committee. I'm Pat Carr. I'm with the Department of Health and Social Services, and I head up the section of health planning and systems development. And I may speak through the chair to Representative Seaton's comment about leaves of absence. And it's in the work that we're doing at this point in time, it seems to be working more efficiently to have quarterly payments so that all checks are written at a calendar quarter. But with people coming and going, it usually, as Liz commented, that if a person comes in midway through a quarter, it allows us to prorate that quarterly payment. The same would be the case with a leave of absence, the way it's working now, at least, unless there's different intent by the sponsor, that we would leave of absences for things such as maternity leave, death of a family, severe injury, things of that sort would be unpaid. They would not be covered for the time they didn't work. And if they left in the middle of a quarter, we could work with that individual provider to then cover their proportion or their pro rata of the loan that they were due. And then again, if they started up again in the middle of a quarter, we'd probably try to encourage them to start on a quarter so it'd be easier for us. But if they wanted to start midway in a quarter, come back to resume their employment, we have the ability to work with them around that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that clarifies that. So the payments for a calendar quarter are just when the payments are being made, but yes, they're going to be prorated for the time someone's there.
Yes.
And if we can, and your understanding is that procedure for allowable leaves of absence are allowable unpaid leaves of absence.
Yes, under special conditions that would are medically necessary or emergency types of situations.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. Any other questions anyone wants to leave on the table that our hardworking sponsor will and his staff will have to deal with this week? Yes, seeing none, we're adjourned at 4:30, and we'll be back on Thursday.
Yeah, you're over.